You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today, we'll hear from the vice chair of the local Democratic Party about how the February 3rd presidential caucuses will work. Also, we hear from a very young Democrat who's been closely following all of the candidates. And the story of how a South Dakota college basketball coach rescued a family stranded in last weekend's blizzard. Saul Phillips ended up getting lost on back roads, trying to beat the storm to Wayne State on Friday night.
I can't see well enough to turn around, so I can't go back. I'm just stuck. I don't know what I'm going to do.
That's when Phillips saw another vehicle caught in the snow with three people stranded inside.
They all pile out through the snow. They get into my car, and the 20-some-year-old lady in my back seat, the first words out of her mouth is, "I'm in labor."
Coming up on this week's Exchange, you can hear an interview with Phillips and Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. But first, a report on a controversy on the Western Iowa Tech campus involving international students and an exchange program. The president of Western Iowa Tech Community College held a news conference on Tuesday to respond to allegations made by a group of international students. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer reports on the past 2 days of developments.
We are shocked and saddened.
Dr. Terry Merle says 60 students from Chile and Brazil arrived for the school year through the J-1 visa exchange program. On Monday, two advocacy groups claimed the college engaged in human trafficking by luring the students with free tuition, housing, food, then forcing them to work long hours at minimum wage factory jobs. They say some of the students were afraid to speak up because the college threatened to send them home. Dr. Merle says that is not the case.
And heard about many of these concerns for the first time yesterday. We will work with these students to find solutions. Western Iowa Tech is in the opportunity business, and we continue and will continue to find opportunities for these students.
Dr. Merle says the students are not responsible for paying for airfare, tuition fees, or housing, and he's working to try to get food covered as well. Western Iowa Tech provided scholarships to offset the cost, as well as the businesses involved in the program. Dr. Merle says the U.S. State Department reviewed the J-1 program back in November, and modifications to the program needed to be made. The program was shortened to 1 year instead of two, and students are required to have internships based on their career choices. About a half dozen internships in robotics still need to be filled. Several of the students already have internships in the culinary field. Five students did return to their home countries with airfare provided by the college.
The thing I can say is we went into this with high aspirations for our students and found out there's a lot of bureaucracy in this program. We work very hard to make sure that we do the right thing. And so we welcome the State Department coming in and providing that guidance for us. We have continued to stay in contact with the State Department. Not required to do that, but we want to make sure that we have the highest value program that we can absolutely have.
Dr. Merle says he's not sure if Western Iowa Tech will continue with the J-1 program. The college hasn't recruited new students for next year. The college had been working with J&L staffing to help recruit students and help with job placement. Dr. Merle says J&L did not organize internships and the college is no longer working with the company. J&L did not return phone calls from Siouxland Public Media News. Several dozen staff members attended the news conference to show support for Western Iowa Tech, as well as a half dozen J-1 students who say they are happy with the experience they received at the college.
We knew that things weren't perfect with the program, and we knew that the students were struggling. I can tell you that we did not understand the extent of frustration that existed in our students. And are troubled by that.
The board president of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement listened to Dr. Merle's comments and said, quote, "This sounds like modern day slavery, complete with a company store in the company town. And it's outrageous that this is happening at a state community college with companies doing business in Iowa." The group also added college representatives and elected officials must guarantee the safety of the impacted international students with no evictions, no debt, and no deportations. For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
For a look at the statement made on Tuesday by the president of Western Iowa Tech Community College that holds the license for KWIT KOJI Radio, check out our website, kwit.org. We also posted new releases from the advocacy groups and links to documentation they say supports their claims. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Iowa presidential caucuses will take place on February 3rd after many months of campaigning and more than two dozen candidates. The world-renowned caucuses are a model of voter engagement, say some, but they can be complicated for a first-timer or for someone who hasn't taken part in a while. Morningside Professor of History Greg Gelcher is the vice chair of the Woodbury County Democratic Party. He's also a caucus chair this year. Gelcher explains what you have to do to take part in the caucuses and how the whole process works.
Perhaps we should start with who can caucus. Each precinct has a caucus site, and you can participate in the caucus if you live in that precinct. If you are a registered Democrat, but of course you can register at the caucus site that night, or you could change your registration that night if you're a Republican who would like to participate in the Democratic caucus, for instance, or an independent. You come in, you sign up as a Democrat. You could always change that the next day, but it allows you to participate. And if you are at least 17 years old and will be turning 18 on November 3rd, 2020, then you can participate as well.
So a lot more people than I would have thought can participate in this.
Indeed. And as we saw in 2016, sometimes you are met with a much greater than anticipated number of people showing up to participate. That was, I think, a large part of the difficulties we had in 2016, that pretty much every precinct in Iowa was overwhelmed with turnout. And we found, you know, we didn't have enough forms, didn't have enough space. It was a bit chaotic. And then we had a reflection of that, we had a large number of people who were new to the caucus, who had never caucused before or hadn't caucused in many years, and they were a little unsure of the process. So,
and the process, has it changed significantly from, I don't know, maybe 2012, 2016?
There has been one significant change since 2016. This year, on the Democratic side, they will be using presidential preference cards. In the past, we basically, we allowed people to divide up according to the candidate they supported, and you'd point out, this corner of the room, for instance, in 2016, this corner of the room, if you support Hillary Clinton, you can go to that corner. If you support Bernie Sanders, you go to this other corner. And if you're here to support Martin O'Malley, this third corner. And then you take a head count. Well, 2016 showed us that if you have a lot of people in a small space, taking that head count can be pretty tricky and time consuming because people are moving around, they're crowded together. So this year they introduced, in an attempt to make it more efficient and the count more accurate, these presidential preference cards. So when you come in, the first thing we do is we determine the viability threshold. So we take account of the number of people who show up. Oh, and by the way, you must show up by 7 p.m. You must literally be in line by 7 p.m. If not, then you can't participate. We should be opening the doors and most of these precincts between 6 and 6:30 p.m. But anyway, once everybody's in and registered, we take a head count, and there's a preset number of delegates that each precinct can elect based on prior attendance at caucuses. And basically, for most of the precincts in Woodbury County, the viability threshold will be 15%. But we have to do this count. We have to know how many people are there. And then we will ask those people to divide up according to the candidate that they support. And then we will go around and do, as part of our headcount, we will give each person one of these presidential preference cards. And once they've divided up, they sign the name of the candidate they support, and they sign their own name on the front side of the card. That's after the first alignment. Any group that has made the threshold, those people are now locked in. They will turn their cards over to the precinct chair for each candidate. So each candidate will have picked a precinct chair. They collect those cards. So those people are now locked in. They will not move. Any person who finds themselves in a group that did not make the viability threshold, they will be given a second chance to realign. And they can join a group that's already viable, or they can join up with other non-viable groups and create a viable group, or they could just stay where they are. And at the end of that second realignment, those people who participated in the second realignment, they flip their card over, they write the change on the back, and they sign it, and basically we're done with the alignment. That's a big change, and that should make the process much more efficient and much more exact, give some added legitimacy to the process.
What about this idea that some Democrats had about letting people take part by phone remotely, and it turned out this couldn't be done, correct?
Not so much that it couldn't be done. There were concerns about the security of doing that. As we know, there are concerns in general about election security. The IDP was having difficulty, I think, figuring out a way to make this work and seem secure. And it's very, very unfortunate because it would have been nice for people who, have trouble traveling or are out of the city, out of the country. My son is currently teaching English in Japan. He participated in his first caucus in 2016. He was actually my caucus secretary at Precinct 10. He had a wonderful time. He was really looking forward to participating again in the caucus, but now he cannot.
It does seem like that's a problem in general when people talk about the caucuses, concerns they have is that people who can't make it, who they work. I've heard it called an under-enfranchisement of certain voters, that they just, they're just not capable of going. And some people have said that either they should move away from the caucus system or Iowa should make it more streamlined and available. But it does seem like, like it should be a fair process, but sometimes it just doesn't work out that way.
Well, that's also true of Election Day in general. I mean, not everybody can make it to the polls on Election Day. But if they were to fix the problem, I think the trying to make it so that people could participate off-site would be the better bet. Because if we move away from the caucus, of course, we're going to lose our first-in-the-nation status. New Hampshire is locked in as the first-in-the-nation primary. We get our first-in-the-nation status because we do the caucus. We are the first-in-the-nation caucus. If we let the caucus go, we will likely lose our first in the nation status. We will likely be pushed back in the election calendar. We will not get the attention that we have been enjoying. And we are spoiled in Iowa. We know that. If we lose the caucus, we will probably lose the candidates. We will lose all the money that this caucus system brings in. It would be very unfortunate.
Do you think there's a chance of that?
I think 2020 will be a real test. I think the nation will be looking at us very closely. If we do not, on the Democratic side at least, pull off a well-run, legitimate-seeming caucus, we will be in trouble. Because there are a lot of states that have been arguing for a long time that we don't deserve to go first, that we are too small a state. We are not representative enough of a state.
And not representative of the Democratic Party is what I've heard a lot.
That too, though I would disagree with all those assertions. But nevertheless, those are the attacks that have been repeatedly lodged, including by candidates who've run in Iowa.
Julian Castro.
Julian Castro most recently. But I will say, based on, I'm an outsider in a sense. I moved to Iowa in 1996 from, I grew up in Pennsylvania. The caucus system was new to me. But what I can say, based on my own observations, is that Iowans really do take this caucus system seriously. They turn out for events. They vet the candidates carefully. And I think for that reason, the results of the caucus are fairly good. I mean, on the Democratic side, we have, let's see, in the 12 caucuses since, starting in 1972, we have picked the winner. By winner, I mean the person who ultimately won the nomination on the Democratic side 8 out of 12 times. It would have been 9, except in 1992, Tom Harkin ran as a favorite son candidate, and there was no way anybody was going to beat Tom Harkin in Iowa.
Yeah.
And even on the Republican side, they've been 6 of 11.
So where are you going to be on caucus night?
That's another change. Normally, I would be running Precinct 10, which is the precinct that I reside in. Because we have suffered a shortage of volunteers, they enhanced the training this year, again, to try to correct for 2016. And we're a bit short of people, veteran people who've run a caucus before. So some of us are being sent to other precincts. I myself, last I heard, was being sent to Precinct 8, which is going to meet at Liberty Elementary School.
You're one of the caucus chairs.
Correct.
And that's a big responsibility.
This year in particular, as I said, there seems to be added pressure on us to run a good caucus, run a caucus that everybody considers legitimate in the end. And so there's been more training, much more training, more formal training. We've been provided more guidance by the IDP this year. But of course, this ultimately rests on the goodwill of volunteers like myself. I mean, none of the caucus chairs will get paid. None of the caucus secretaries will get paid. This is a volunteer enterprise. And when you're dealing with volunteers, you get some people who do better than others, just for various reasons. So
when we talk about the caucuses, the goal is to apportion delegates, right?
Yes, correct. The ultimate goal here is to apportion delegates. So it's very important how many people are standing in each group supporting each candidate. That's why we count very carefully those numbers. And we use those numbers to figure out which group gets which number of delegates out of the total that is allotted to the precinct. And again, the total number of delegates is based on prior attendance at that precinct at caucus. We are apportioning delegates, those delegates will go on to the county convention, and the process kind of repeats itself there, and then they go on to the state convention, and then ultimately we have the final number of delegates. Ultimately, it is a winner-take-all, but it's not, that is not decided on February 3rd, which is caucus night. Monday, February 3rd is caucus, but it's precinct caucus. So this is where the process starts. But it is important in the eyes of these campaigns that they have a good showing here at the start, because this is the first vote in the United States.
Right. Gotcha.
So it could give a candidate real momentum, even if they don't finish first. I mean, think about 2008 when John McCain, participated in the Iowa caucus. He finished fourth overall with 13% of the vote, but because he did so much better than where he was expected to finish and where, you know, his, you know, standing at the polls going into the caucus was, it helped propel him forward. And then he started gaining momentum, and he ultimately went on to get the nomination as Republican candidate for president in 2008.
That was Greg Gelcher. He's the vice chair of the Woodbury County Democratic Party. He explained the caucus process and what you need to do to take part in the February 3rd presidential nominating process. You can find your caucus location by going to www.iwillvote.com, and you must show up for your caucus by 7 p.m. Just said, the Iowa caucuses are less than 2 weeks away, and for the past several months, candidates have sought out the support of Siouxlanders. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer covered several of these campaign events and found some insights from a young but informed source who has aspirations of her own.
Disco lights and an occasional Disney tune set the scene for roller skating night at Girls Inc. in Sioux City, a gymnasium full of young ladies and one a bit beyond her years.
I'm Maggie. I'm 10.
A tenacious and at times typical fifth grader.
I like to play soccer, sing, play guitar, and do art. I want to be the president when I grow up.
All she knows as a six-year-old is Trump says he's going to build a wall between us and Mexico, and some of her friends are Mexican.
Maggie's mother, Tracy Taylor, says her daughter's political aspirations started when Donald Trump became president.
It made me be like, oh my gosh, this is a very important thing, and I need to step into it and, like, do it.
2 years ago, Girls Inc. sent Maggie and Tracy to take our daughters to Congress Day in Washington, D.C.
That, like, fueled my fire.
Today, Maggie doesn't have to go far to see the political system in action, with Iowa holding the first in the nation caucuses.
What are the most important issues for you when it comes to a candidate?
Gun control, immigration, women's rights, and climate change.
Maggie's met about a dozen of the Democratic contenders from the top tier, including Senator Bernie Sanders and Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
We also have to face these huge issues.
It was on the worst snow day that we had.
To a few who dropped out of the race.
Who do you think's been the nicest so far?
Cory Booker and and better or worse.
Maggie favored both men and now puts Andrew Yang at the top of her list.
Give me a really, really cool high five.
Others also pique her interest.
You also had a chance to meet Tulsi Gabbard?
She was like probably one of my first favorites, and she still is.
So did you get to see Amy Klobuchar when she was here?
Yes, I did. She wasn't as outgoing as the other candidates, but I still really liked her.
Not all of the women in the race appealed to this pint-sized pundit.
You don't want to see Elizabeth Warren? No. Okay.
When it comes to the pursuit of politics, Maggie shares the secret of securing a little of the spotlight.
My mom told me that if you go to the front of the line is either the best or the back of the line is the best, so you can have the, as much time as you want.
However, being the youngest person in the room doesn't hurt either.
So, you have brothers and sisters? What's the name of your school?
Irving.
A couple of weeks ago at a local diner, John Delaney spent several minutes getting to know Maggie and her parents while sharing his ideas for the country.
I believe women and men should have equal rights.
I am learning right along with her, and I hate to say that. That sounds really un-American and not very responsible, but I definitely don't have all the answers, and she challenges me and involves me more than I would be if she weren't interested, for sure.
Maggie's persistence also put her in the middle of a peaceful protest when former Secretary of State John Kerry campaigned for Joe Biden. An acquaintance on her father's side.
My grandpa died. He sent flowers. One reason he is super good, well, a good candidate, is because he's been in the office already about 4 years ago. 4 years ago with Obama.
Why do you want to be president someday, Maggie?
We don't want there to be other presidents, in my opinion, that are like this one, who just don't do what a president is made to be doing. And I want to make sure in 2048 that doesn't happen.
Skeptics might think Tracy Taylor influences her daughter's decisions and thoughts, but she says that's far from the truth.
We try to give her both sides of the argument, but she's a smart kid. We don't talk really about politics at our house, which sounds crazy for someone who wants to be president, but my family is very much Republicans, and my husband's family is very much Democrats, and so it's not something we talk about at the dinner table very often. A lot of adults question what my husband and I do with her politically, but because she comes from it from that idealistic place, it's important for me to let her keep doing it because maybe she can change the world.
But your family actually does have presidential ties anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's my husband's like, I don't know
great,
how many greats.
Great uncle.
Several great uncles was Zachary Taylor.
And the funny story is that he died of like spoiled milk.
Food poisoning from spoiled milk.
And I say this now, maybe that's why I'm lactose intolerant.
Generations later, another Taylor aspires to be in the White House as she sizes up the options for this year between homework, hobbies, and hanging out with friends. He has this advice for the adults.
This is the most important election, so you should probably go out and vote.
And maybe someday you'll see the name of Maggie Taylor on the ballot. For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Maggie has more political plans for this summer. Fourth District Congressional candidate J.D. Shulton has asked Maggie to join him as he travels the district in his RV so she can get a feel of what campaigning is really like on the road. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. On Tuesday, January 28th, the Siouxlanders have a chance to get an in-depth look at an effort by the Sierra Club, which is pushing for a transition to clean energy. Katie Rock is the campaign representative for Iowa with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal. She will be traveling from Des Moines to take part in two different events. She talked to Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer about her thoughts on the impact of coal energy.
So the Beyond Coal campaign is a national effort by the Sierra Club that's been in place since 2010, and we have staff all over the country working on this. Our goal is to retire the U.S. coal fleet by 2030, and we are halfway there not only in years here in 2020, but we are halfway there in coal plants as well. We just closed our 301 and 302 coal plant that just this year already.
Now, I know in doing previous stories with MidAmerican Energy here in Iowa, they said that's actually something that they are working towards as well.
Yeah. Yes, and it's a hard thing to do, but especially since 2017 when we had the crossover between coal and renewable sources like wind and solar in terms of cost, things have sped up, even though the Trump administration has actively sought to prop up a lot of fossil fuel industries. So in 2017, new wind and solar is now the lowest cost option for electricity generation. It's cheaper than coal. And so what we've seen is our strategy in a lot of states has shifted from one that's really heavy on air pollution and dirty coal plants to one that is an economic argument along with the dirty the dirty coal plant argument.
Do you think MidAmerican yep. Energy is doing enough? I know we still have a plant here in the Sioux City area.
Right. There is a plant in the Sioux City area, and the largest coal plant in Iowa is in Council Bluffs, also in western Iowa. And then the other plants are kind of mostly scattered or in eastern Iowa, in southeast Iowa. And I think they are behind other utilities. They have, you know, invested a lot in expanding wind power in Iowa. But we saw it in the last month. The DNR released their emissions report from 2018, and emissions in Iowa actually ticked up a little bit. And it is because we've continued to run these coal plants, even as we're expanding wind. We've kept all of them online, and I think they are running, the data shows that they are running more often than most people are really aware. And our emissions in this last decade, where we've expanded wind energy in Iowa, our emissions are still the same. Because we've kept these coal plants online. And it shouldn't be a surprise that I, of course, think that MidAmerican could be doing more. So MidAmerican is owned by Berkshire Hathaway Energy Holdings Company. And they also have another utility that they own in the western U.S. called PacifiCorp. And just last year, PacifiCorp announced plans publicly to retire their entire coal fleet by 2040. So a third will retire by 2025, another third by around 2030, and then the last third by 2040. MidAmerican could easily release a plan like that, and they still haven't. And so they're kind of considered, they're lifted up, especially in the trade press, as kind of a model utility in how much wind power that they own. But we still haven't seen them announce a retirement plan for their coal fleet.
And when it comes to coal energy, what are the impacts on the environment? This might be common sense type of stuff, but how serious is it that there are coal plants still online?
Well, I mean, the big concern, you know, is, of course, greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, but also sulfur dioxide and nitrous oxides. So a lot of older coal plants have had to attach these scrubbers onto their towers that will limit the sulfur dioxide emissions because it's a really potent gas and it leads to things like acid rain and all sorts of respiratory problems. And that's an expensive investment if they've added a scrubber tower to their plant. So rather at this point, rather than adding any scrubber towers to make the coal plant a little bit cleaner, we argue that it's best to just make a plan to retire that plant and shift to clean energy. So that's probably the first one. The other, that's just air pollution. There's also water pollution. Nearly every every plant makes coal ash, and how that ash is handled, it ends up being a concern for surface water and especially groundwater pollution. And so nearly every coal plant in the U.S., the coal ash leaks into the water at some point. It's just a matter of when. And so that's also a major concern around the country.
That was Katie Rock with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Her first event is at noon on Tuesday at the Holiday Inn in Sioux City. She will be sharing her mission with the attendees of the Siouxland Progressive Women's Luncheon. That evening, she'll be the guest speaker at the Northwest Iowa Sierra Club's Fourth Tuesday program at the First Unitarian Church in Sioux City. The event starts at 6:30. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. Food insecurity is an ever-present problem around the country and here in Siouxland. The Food Bank of Siouxland has long been a source of food and compassion for people when they're just not able to fill their pantries. Linda Scheid is the executive director of the food bank. She says this last year, the bank distributed more food than ever before. Scheid explains how the food bank works and previews the organization's yearly fundraiser.
You've got this food bank, and I don't think I really understood it at first either.
No, most people don't.
You've got this big food bank, a big place.
Yes, it is.
And then you have food pantries.
Right.
And so how does all that work?
So the food bank is the warehouse, and we bring food together from so many different resources. And then it's our job to bring it in to care for it. So we count it, we weigh it, we sort it, we store it dry in the dry side, frozen product in the freezer, refrigerated product in the cooler. We put it on an inventory so our agency partners, which include the food pantries, can order that product. And then we prepare orders for those agencies. So whether we deliver it or they come pick it up, product that's donated to us by Tyson, for example, ultimately can go to the Salvation Army, or it can go to the Gospel Mission, or it can go to St. Thomas Episcopal Church for their food pantry. By definition, we're the warehouse. By definition, a food pantry is an organization dedicated to helping individuals and families struggling with food security. So you look at your cabinets and go, oh my gosh, I don't have enough food for myself or myself and my family. So you go to a food pantry, and they're going to send you home with bags or a box or whatever to take to your own kitchen to prepare your own meals going forward. And some of those pantries will seek to provide you with food to last a couple of days. Some will do more than that. Some will say, that's okay, come back next week. Some will say, if you've been here this week, we can't help you again for 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months. Every pantry has their own guidelines as to how they operate. But they all, when they are partners with us, have to adhere to some baseline regulations. Basic things like if a family comes in and says, we're looking for food assistance, and you send them home with food, they don't pay you for it. It's free to the individual that's struggling, that there's no discrimination in who gets food and how much food they get and how it's handled. All of that is required. And we inspect our agencies annually to make sure they're playing by the same rules and that everybody is really there for the right reasons and looking out for those in need and caring for them with caution, with dignity, and respect for the individual who needs assistance.
We used to talk a lot about hunger, but now I think I hear more and I have more conversations about food insecurity, right, which is a much broader topic.
Right. And food insecurity really, in its base definition, is all about people who don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And so when I first came into this business and I learned about all of that, I used to say food insecurity is the technical term for people who are hungry. In a way, that's still true. But I also think using the term food insecurity opens up the whole conversation around what, why? Because in our neck of the woods, it's not about a lack of food. It's not that there isn't enough food to feed our community. but there are a lot of people that don't have enough wherewithal, enough money in their wallet and their checkbook to go to the grocery store and meet their own nutritional needs. So now we're talking about that whole bigger conversation around why, how did this happen, and what are the solutions to that? So we've always said hunger is the most solvable challenge of our time. If someone is hungry, let's get them food. We'll feed them. Now they're not hungry. Boom, problem solved. Food insecurity is that bigger picture that has a much bigger, broader implication, because that's not so easily fixed. And there are those who will tell me, by handing them food, you're making it easy. They don't have to solve the bigger problem. I don't think it's quite that simple. I think there's way more to it.
Do you see any difference in the number of people or sort of the backgrounds of people who are coming in since the passage of the last farm bill? People were saying, well, they're going to have these work requirements for people to get food stamps. People are going to have problems with that. Have you seen that cause any problems?
You know, we don't see the individuals and families at the food bank. We serve the agencies. It's the agencies that see those individuals. So on one hand, I will tell you I'm probably not well equipped or prepared to answer that question. On the other hand, what I can document is the dramatic uptick in the demand from the agencies. So they are seeing more people coming through their door. So I do believe there are more people that are struggling at this point in time. Single biggest month in our history was October of 2019. And we distributed 275,000 pounds of food in 1 month. The second biggest month, December. The biggest quarter in our history is the quarter we just completed, October, November, December. 2019 had, I believe, 8 of the biggest months in our entire history in 1 year. So the uptick is huge. When we set that new record in October, it broke a record that had just been set in March with 240,000 pounds. So we went from 240 to 275,000 pounds in a month. That's not just breaking the record, that's shattering it. And that tells me how many people are out there having a hard time, how many people are really struggling to make ends meet. And if you're paying this much for the house or the rent or the apartment, if you're paying this much for the car, if you're putting this much into your gas tank so you can go to work, if you're spending money in ways you cannot adjust. You have to make that full rent payment. You have to put the gas in the car and then give them as much as the pump says you owe now. What you can adjust is how much you have in your grocery budget. And so that's been taking the hit. That gets squeezed time after time after time. And then pretty soon it's not enough for the month and you wind up looking for other resources like food pantries or feeding programs where you can go in and sit down and have breakfast or lunch or dinner.
How is the food bank financed? Where do you get your funding?
People tend to think that we're a government agency, that maybe we are drawing on the federal government, the local government, the state, the city, and that's not true at all. We're an independent, nonprofit, community-based organization. We are part of a national network called Feeding America, and that gives us a lot of things, but not funding. So it's up to us. And so we do have a system called shared maintenance, where our agency partners pay 18 cents a pound for the majority of the donated product. There are some purchased products, and so that's at 27 cents a pound. There's a lot of product that's free. So that product, like produce, which is one of the top two product categories in the entire listing for what we distributed in our last fiscal year, and I love that, that all goes for free. So our agency partners help us with about 40% of our funding. In addition to that, we do a lot of fundraising. So we have a direct mail program. We have events we do throughout the year. We write grants. So we do a lot to try and bring sufficient funding through the door.
How important is your yearly fundraiser?
Oh, this is critical. And our favorite is the one that's right around the corner. That's Empty Bowls on February 7th. It's our signature event. You know, we do a golf tournament in the summer. So many of our fellow nonprofits do golf tournaments, and they're fun, and I love them, and they're great. But Empty Bowls is unique to us. This is a fundraiser and a hunger awareness event, excuse me. It's really a very special evening, but we talk about hunger and we talk about, wow, there are people who truly don't have enough to eat. And our symbol for that is we have local artists, bless their heart, who make and donate all these beautiful handcrafted, one by one, they're all different ceramic bowls. And every guest that comes gets to take a ceramic bowl home with them. And that's their visual reminder of people who truly have an empty bowl and don't have enough to eat on a regular basis. And so while we have a really fun night of warm soup on a cold winter night, there are people that are struggling to have even that. And I think it's important to bring that forward and talk about that and make people aware of that.
That was Linda Scheid, the executive director of the Food Bank of Siouxland. The Food Bank's annual Empty Bowls fundraiser takes place Friday, February 7th. For more information, go to siouxlandfoodbank.org. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, the winter storm that hit Siouxland with a vengeance over the weekend put a college basketball coach into a treacherous situation. Saul Phillips is the head coach at Northern State in Aberdeen, South Dakota. His team played Friday night in Sioux Falls and took off for Wayne that evening. Phillips planned to stay over in Sioux Falls to visit friends before making the trip on Saturday. However, with the weather forecast looking even more bleak, he took off by car. And that's when the real adventure started. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer heard about the story from a friend in Wayne, Nebraska, and asked Phillips about the situation that has some calling him the Blizzard Hero. Here's a portion of their conversation that starts with Phillips in northeast Nebraska.
I can see it on my phone. If I can get to Wakefield, at least there's a city that maybe I can find a place to tuck in for the night. And so I backtrack. And the roads are as bad as they were when I passed them the first time. As I turn on the road to Wakefield, it's about 8 miles at this point to Wakefield. For the first 2 miles, all of a sudden it lets up a little bit. And I'm like, this is okay. I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it the whole way. This is good. That changed in a hurry, and the roads were worse. The conditions were worse. Not the roads. The conditions were worse than I had dealt with the whole time. So in the course of the next 5 miles, I probably come to a complete stop 3 or 4 times. I've got my window rolled down, looking at the other side of the road just to make sure that I'm not going driving directly into a ditch. Third or fourth time I stop, I see headlights facing me in a ditch. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm at a complete stop, crawling forward ahead 5 miles an hour at a time when the wind dies just enough that I can see I'm on road. And I'm at a dead stop, and there's a car in the ditch. So I walk over, knock on the window. There's 3 people in the car. I said, hey, listen, you're not getting out of here tonight. There's no way they're going to get a rescue crew out to you. Let me at least get you to town. I didn't notice anything different at the time, but again, significant amount of snow. They all pile out through the snow. They get into my car, and the 20-some-year-old lady in my back seat, the first words out of her mouth is, I'm in labor. That's when stuff turned a little bit. I said, are you having contractions? She said, yes. I said, how often? She goes, pretty much all the time. Yeah, that's how we got into this spot.
Wow. So here you are. You're basically stranded in the middle of what seems to be nowhere. And you have this emergency situation kind of looming. What happens next?
Okay, so lady that had been driving the car was probably in her 40s, and she did not speak English. It turns out Naomi, who's the woman who gave birth eventually, her fiance was not talking much, and I didn't know at the time, but apparently he was trying to fend off an asthma attack with the cold wind and the stress and his wife going into labor in the ditch. Again, I found this out later. I didn't know if he could speak English or not. All I know is that he was trying to talk to 911 on the phone, and eventually he just handed me the phone. I'm on the phone with 911. I said, listen, as far as I can tell, I am exactly 1.5 miles north of Wakefield. I think I was a little closer in retrospect as I went back and did a little detective work. 1.5 miles north of Wakefield, and I don't know if you can make it here in these conditions. I certainly... I'd be real careful, but if you're going to come now, because we're close. I've been through this 3 times as a dad, And I know what the end looks like, and we're there. And I can hear the plow and the ambulance saying, I don't know if we're going to make it. This is zero visibility out here. I don't know if we can make it. So eventually, it was 20, 25 minutes, I think, felt like a year. I see the lights of the emergency responders, and I said, keep coming. You're close. We're really close.
Naomi made it to the hospital in Wayne just in time to give birth to a healthy baby girl. The local fire and rescue department sent Saul Phillips a message expressing their gratitude in helping out with a precarious and potentially dangerous situation. However, he doesn't necessarily see himself as a hero.
The other thing I will say is that I shouldn't have been out on that road, and I know that. I didn't intend to be. I was communicating with the bus that was a half hour in front of me that got in safe to Wayne with no issue whatsoever. And all of a sudden, I'm in the soup, and I feel terrible that I was putting myself and other people at risk by being, I shouldn't have been out there. They were driving their car, and the bottom line is they didn't have a choice. They had to get to a hospital. I could have stayed in Sioux City. I could have done anything. And the emergency responders that got out there, they put themselves at risk. It was dicey. I can tell you, they were at home. It's the volunteer fire and rescue department. They put themselves at risk to get to us. There's a lot of neat people in this story, and I kind of view myself as I just got a front row seat to a whole bunch of other people doing wonderful things. It's life affirming. It's wonderful. And again, at the end of the day, the bottom line is Hazel's here, and Hazel's mother's going to have a heck of a story to tell her someday.
That was Saul Phillips. You can hear his 12-minute interview with Siouxland Public Media Sheila Brummer on our website, kwit.org. And there's also a link to a blog written by his wife about that situation. She focuses on kindness in her writing, and she says her husband was an example of what she advocates. And by the way, if you're wondering about the basketball game, Northern State beat Wayne State College 82-72 on Saturday night. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.